Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see. Nothing to see. Nothing to see.
Experimental radio produced by NASCAD University.
You are listening to Nothing to See Here, experimental radio from NASCAD University. This program is called Topsy's Revenge.
Hey man, you want girls, pills, grass? Come on, I show you a good time. This place has everything. Come on, I show you.
Dreamland.
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 Dreaming.
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 Entering.
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 World.
There was a silent film made of Topsy's death. It was a 1 minute short produced by Thomas Edison's manufacturing company. The camera was there, part of the semicircle of about 1,500 spectators at the new Luna Park on January 4th. Topsy was standing, surrounded by people. The camera started rolling. And then the 6,000 volts of this new invention called electricity were sent into the elephant's body. At first, nothing happened. Then the quivering, then the throes, then the smoke rising out of the bottom of her feet. The film captures the muscles of the elephant going limp and lifeless, the elephant remaining momentarily upright after the muscles had gone, and then the muscles stiffen and the huge beast collapses into the dust. The whole event took about 10 seconds, and the camera captured almost everything. The difference between the film version and actually being there is that in the film, when the elephant falls to the ground, there's silence. In 1903, at Luna Park, the earth momentarily rumbled.
Try to sleep, lamb, take us to dreamland. I am unhappy, far from my woman. Take me to dreamland, land of the banyan, land of plentiful pleasures of pines, potatoes on tables, laden with good things. Eat at my table, she cried to the vineyards, calling the workers home from the meadows. Man, you are evil, get out of my garden. Ours is a good place, home of the reindeer. Sell me your pony, your fast golden pony. I need his strength and his terrible footsteps. Riding the prairie, just me and my angel. Just try and stop us, we're going to love. Open your window, woman of Palestine. Throw down your raiment and cover us over.
Thank you.
As the day comes to an end, the twilight dissolves the surfaces, absorbing their colors, leaving their reflections suspended in space. The luminous transparency in open spaces condenses into beams and phosphorescence. Things lose their separateness. The shadows advance over the colors, and the contours that they outlined are lost. Darkness infiltrates the landscape, obliterating its paths and filling up its open plains. Overhead, the blue of the atmosphere recedes. The starlights drift over unmeasurable distances. Itself is there. There is no longer anything to see. The cries, murmurs, and rumbles no longer locate separate beings signaling one another or colliding with one another on observable coordinates. Shouts or distant lights do not mark locations in the night, but make the whole of night vibrant. The odors drift. The ground which we feel and which extends indefinitely about us no longer supports things in their places. What we touch adheres to our hands and is no longer the contour of something closed over its own structure and substance. The rain no longer streaks the distance of its fall. Though there is no longer anything to see, we see and do not see nothingness. We see the darkness. The night is not a dark mass that stops our sight on the surface of our eyes. Our look goes out into the night, which is vast and boundless. The sense of sight can be taught and acute in the depths of the dark. The night is not a substance but an event. It pervades a space freed from barriers and horizons. It extends a duration which moves without breaking up into moments. Night comes incessantly in a presence which does not mark a residue of its past, nor outline a different presence to come. The darkness which softly wipes away the urgencies and the destinations of the hard edges of reality is felt in an enjoyment that conforms to its depths without resistance, that gives itself over to the rumble of the city and the murmur of nature. to the silken, mossy, and liquid substances that caress our bodies, to the odors and savors adrift in their own space. The visible night gives way to a high noon of sounds, odors, and textures. Then, as the night abolishes the menaces from the surfaces and back alleys of the landscape, it insinuates the menace of its own disquietude.
Edison began electrocuting animals in the 1880s as a way of demonstrating the dangers of alternating current or AC electricity distribution. Edison favored direct current or DC technology. To bolster support for DC power, he and his team electrocuted cats, dogs, calves, horses, and an orangutan with deadly AC electricity. But Edison's most ambitious demonstration was the electrocution of a 6-ton elephant. Topsy, an Indian elephant living at the Luna Park Zoo at Coney Island, had killed three of her keepers, including one who tried to feed her a lit cigarette. The zoo sentenced Topsy to death by public hanging. But opposition by the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals led the owners to turn to Edison, who was happy to use Topsy to prove that even an elephant was vulnerable to the dangers of AC. On January 4, 1903, Edison's company filmed the execution in front of a crowd of 1,500 spectators. In case the electrocution failed, Topsy was fed cyanide-laced carrots before over 6,000 volts of AC power shot through her body. The poison proved unnecessary. Edison's demonstrations persuaded some people that electrocution was a valid form of execution.
Each day we sleep, making ourselves as dormant as we can, stripping away the accidental accretions of the day, and gathering ourselves once more in the essential life where we are untouched by external relations. Death, by contrast, is nothing like sleep. Death is a subversion from below, a corruption by means of failing parts, when vital components fail in such a way that they can no longer be refreshed or replaced.
I'm
Then we hear a whistle like a bosun's pipe. And the carnival immediately begins, gradually mixing rain, thunder, bullfight, football, playground, war, penny arcade. Babylon fading.
Night is not nothing. It is real. It is a presence without boundaries, frontiers, or limits. It is without ends, goals, or termination. In insomnia, one finds one's existence and one's wakefulness maintained by the incessant oncoming of the night. Insomnia longs for sleep, from which the day will waken it. Insomnia suffers from not being able to put an end to itself, not being able to die, to act, to cast forth a project, is to take hold of an end. It is the end we take hold of that can make our movement determinant. Insomnia is existence divested from every form of project. Existence as indeterminate endurance. All the indoor elephants that glide around the room unnoticed. Who let them in? They never forget a face. They never look you in the eye. They never return your gaze. Not like the bull in the china shop.
video.
Dreaming. Dreaming. Entering the dream world.
I'm falling asleep. I'm falling into sleep. And I'm falling there by the power of sleep. Just as I fall asleep from exhaustion, just as I drop from boredom, as I fall on hard times, as I fall in general, sleep sums up all these falls. It gathers them together. Sleep is proclaimed and symbolized by the sign of the fall. The more or less swift descent or sagging faintness. To these we can add how I'm fainting from pleasure or from pain. This fall, in its turn, in one or another of its versions, mingles with the others. When I fall into sleep, when I sink, everything has become indistinct. Pleasure and pain. Pleasure itself and its own pain. Pain itself and its own pleasure. One passing into the other produces exhaustion, lassitude, boredom, lethargy, untying, unmooring. The boat gently leaves its moorings and drifts. The pain of pleasure comes when pleasure can no longer bear itself. It's when it gives itself up and stops allowing itself solely to enjoy. Exhausted lovers fall asleep. The pleasure of pain is when pain insists, not without perversity, that it should be sustained and savored even while it grows increasingly inflamed. It's when it reveals, if only in its own lament, it doesn't just let itself struggle and protest against the pain. By itself, it agrees to fall asleep in a way. In the sense that we say, put the pain to sleep, even if it means enduring a dreadful reawakening. In any case, faintness and falling consist in not allowing a state to persist with a tension natural to it. A state of tension, then, that is not a state. With its tension and its intention slackening, giving up, activity into fatigue, interest into boredom, hope or confidence into distress, pleasure into displeasure, rejection of pain into remorse, delectation of it. Keenness becomes dull, momentum is lost, and alertness falls asleep.
We think we are describing you the world, but we are only describing the frame through which we look at it. In other words, we are going around in circles, like a Ferris wheel. This is what we call circular reasoning. What a philosopher would call tautology. What is a tautology? That which is tautological. For Wittgenstein, this was logic, and all logic is ultimately a tautology, a giant ride on the Ferris wheel of logic.
When I dream, all I dream of is colors and textures. You know, there's no one I know, there's no one I see, there's no one I believe in. It's just, it's pinks, it's blues, it's Dijon mustard yellows. It's anything you can choose. It's a sensory overload. The brain firing off in all sorts of different directions, but unable to comprehend anything that it had dealt with in the day beforehand. You know, it's, they say dreams are what you are, how you make sense of the world. You know, the brain needs time to stop and reset, catalog and format and organize. It needs time to make predictions. You know, it looks for the patterns in the world. It says, hey, this happened, this happened, this happened. Well, I bet that's gonna happen. You know. But not me. No, when I dream, it's like I've entered a whole nother universe where physicality is not a thing. Where there is no time, there's no space, there is no smells, there's nothing to see, there's just what you feel. It's synthetic, it's emphatic, it's erratic, it's uncontrollable, it's all above me, all around me, all below me. My dreams are pure moments free of anything that came before or after. My dreams exist for me.
The sleeping person closes his eyes so he can open them tonight. Inside himself, beneath the eyelids that sink with sleep, and that were already there, throughout the whole day, solely that there might be evoked, lowering their awnings at times. The always possible imminence of night in broad daylight, the possibility, if not the necessity, of escaping the solicitudes of wakefulness. What he sees is nothing other than night itself. For night, though a major difference from day, is no more external than it is internal. Day is wholly outside. Day is before our eyes, at the tip of our hands and feet, on our tongue, and in the porches of our ears. Night identifies outside with inside. The eye sees in it the underside of things, the back of eyelids, the invisible layer of the other side of things, the underpinnings, crypts, skins turned inside out. It is the world of substance, that which exists underneath and itself exists on nothing else. That which is not accident or attribute, that is, it comes to nothing and refers or applies to nothing except to itself. That which is entirely its own, belonging to no other subject or support, to no authority of validation or justification.
Concrete, not to be confused with cement or mortar. Concrete is a composite material composed of coarse aggregate bonded together with a fluid cement, which hardens over time. Most concretes use lime-based concretes, such as the Portland cement concrete, or concretes made with other hydraulic cements, such as cement fondue. However, asphalt concrete, which is very frequently used for road surfaces, is also a type of concrete where the cement material is bitumen, and polymeric concretes are sometimes used where the cementing material is a polymer. In Portland cement concrete and other hydraulic cement concretes, when the aggregate is mixed together with the dry cement and water, they form a fluid mass that is easily molded onto shape. Sometimes I take the something fluid mass and I mold it over,
you know, a moment of rest in between the big things in life that I needed to do. There was always more to consume or more to accomplish, and sleep never seemed to be all that important. Throughout most of my high school and junior high days, I would stay up as late as I could. I would watch nightly television shows, CNN, Daily Show, all sorts of things late into the night, and then I would be up after only a few hours.
Embedded to provide tensile strength for school, yielding reinforced concrete. Famous concrete structures include the Hoover Dam, the Panama Canal, and the Roman Pantheon. The earliest large-scale uses of concrete technology.
Thank you.
1902, at Luna Park in Coney Island, Topsy, a veteran circus elephant, was fed a lit cigarette by his drunken keeper. Burnt by the cigarette, Topsy instinctively grabbed the keeper and threw him to the ground, killing him instantly. For this, and for similar deaths of two other keepers, Topsy, the bad-tempered elephant, was sentenced to death. But how do you execute an elephant? This problem caught the attention of inventor Thomas Edison, who at that time was caught up in a bitter battle to define the electrical power standards in the US, what was called the War of the Currents, with his arch nemesis George Westinghouse. Edison was promoting the use of his DC, or direct current power, while also trying to smear the reputation of Westinghouse's AC, or alternating current, that was developed by Nikola Tesla. Edison proposed to electrocute poor Topsy using AC power, or what he called Westinghousing the animal, in an attempt to cement in the public's mind the dangers of his rival's invention. The electrocution occurred at Coney Island on January 4th, 1903, in front of 1,500 people. Edison not only provided the electricity, he also used the opportunity to make a film that he hoped would discredit what was, in fact, a much safer form of electrical power. Edison's film, Electrocution of an Elephant, shows Topsy led to his death. He was fed poison carrots that were actually to have little effect on him. A jolt of electricity shoots up through the metal clamps, and the 4.6-ton animal drops dead to the ground. We are used to seeing violence on the screen. It is tempered by the acknowledgement that this is not real violence. With Edison's film, however, it's real. This was an age before films had to disavow the violence depicted on the screen with the phrase, "No animals were harmed in the making of this film." Electrocution of an Elephant was an actuary film. It really happened. This is not a documentary film where the camera is there to record the unfolding of events. The death of Topsy was shaped and staged to serve Edison's explicit purpose as propaganda. This was a snuff film. One of the first times death had been inscribed on film. It was a tragic joining of empty moral spectacle and self-aggrandizing showmanship of the new electrical cinematic age.
I would get through the day, half dazed, drink a lot of pop, you know, not do too much physically demanding things, and then I'd come home and I would sleep for a couple of hours after school, and then it would be up and doing my thing. Again, and, you know, so I would sleep in these chunks of 3 or 4 hours at a time every 12 or 14 hours. As a result, you know, of doing that for many years, it only got worse when I was in university. Didn't have to work, didn't have to maintain a routine. And as a result of that, I, I lost my ability to dream. You know, that was okay. It was, you know, now I have a hard time distinguishing reality from the moments of rest I do get. You know, there was always these games I would play with friends, you know, younger sort of endurance tests, see how late we could stay up, or you know, who could handle the most caffeine, who could do the most exercise and then, you know, stay focused on something afterwards. And as I grew older and as I sort of trained myself away from the need for sleep, my abilities and my reasoning began to wane. And now, you know, I'm up 2-3 days at a time, you know. I pray for sleep. When I do get sleep, it's 4 or 5 hours, never deep. My bed feels uncomfortable. You know, I can't even lay down anymore. I have to fall asleep in a sitting position. You know, and then I'll wake up like that, and I'll start to feel mad at myself because those are 4 or 5 hours where I could have been doing something. But I'm afraid, you know, if I stay up too late or too long, I'll just... Well, you know, there's a reason the military uses sleep deprivation as torture.
Something that happens in quantum mechanics, one of the important innovations of quantum mechanics is that a certain fantasy that held in physics up until then about the possibility of observing something entirely passively, observing it without affecting it in the process of observing it. However things turn out, it's fairly clear now that quantum mechanics will have ended that permanently. Looking at things involves interacting with them, and it involves interacting with them in a way whose effect can't be minimized. No matter how delicate your technology is, no matter how much money you spend, the process, the physical process of making a measurement, has a very profound effect. There have been a whole bunch of speculations in the literature as to what it is about the process of making a measurement that has this effect, and how it is that the process of making measurements have the effects that they do. One of the speculations about this, which had its heyday in the 50s and 60s in the scientific and philosophical literature, was that the active agent here was consciousness. And people were excited about this for all sorts of obvious reasons. It was a very new sort of link between physics and something that had seemed altogether outside of physics up until then. There is still a really important distinction between two quite different ways that you can come at the world. Both of them are imperfect, both of them are messy, both of them are back and forth. But there is a posture of coming at the world with the demand that you're going to find something that makes you feel good, you're going to find something therapeutic, you're going to find that what lies at the center of the universe, what lies at the foundation of all being, is some attractive, powerful, safe, accessible, reassuring image of yourself. But it's imaginable that physics could get to the point, okay, where it could say, look, I have a completely physical explanation of why you just moved your arm. I have a completely physical explanation of why you're now producing the sounds you're producing. I have a completely physical explanation of why you married the person that you did. I have a completely physical explanation of why you wrote all the words in your life that you did. If physics gets to that point, there's going to be more and more of a pressing question of the form. Look, this other stuff you believe in, this non-physical stuff that you believe in, what's it for? What work is it doing in the world? We have a complete account here in terms of physics of everything that seems to be going on, of why you believe, you know, of why to say, you say to people that you believe you have free will. We're going to have a physical account of why you say to people that you believe the world isn't completely physical. That's not going to be a proof that the world is completely physical, but it is going to raise a very awkward question for the person who wants to deny physicalism, if physics gets to this point, mind you. I don't know that it will, okay? But if it does, okay, then there's going to be a very acute question of the form, look, this other stuff you believe in, soul or spirit or whatever it is, what does it do? What's it for? We've got the account of everything in terms of the motions of these particles. Okay? We've already established that it's not what makes you say what you say, it's not what makes you write what you write, it's not what makes you marry who you marry. What work is it doing?
Today, large concrete structures, for example, dams and multi-story car parks, are usually made with reinforced concrete. After the Roman Empire collapsed, the use of concrete became rare until the technology was recently redeveloped in the mid-18th century. Today we live in the concrete era, and the most widely used concrete is man-made material. Whoa, where am I? No, that was wrong. Ignore that one.
On Saturday, May 27th, 1911, at 1:58 a.m., an alarm bell rang in Dreamland. Tinsmiths had been working late into the night repairing the roof on a riot-cold Hellgate when an electrical short plunged them into darkness. Somebody kicked over a bucket of hot tar, and soon Hellgate was burning. The fire spread quickly, galloping through the buildings made of plaster of Paris, hemp fiber, paper mache, and tar. Steeplechase Park, the Warwick's dog and monkey circus, the world's first infant incubator, all lost. By 3:10 a.m., the majestic Dreamland Tower, in all its phallic glory, came crashing down. The wildcats were shocked before they could escape their pens, as exasperated firefighters realized that the merchants had tapped into the high-pressure fire hoses, leaving no water to quench the flames' thirst. Even an attraction called Fighting the Flames, where for years a brigade of midgets had day-to-day extinguished fake fires with midget fire trucks and midget fire hoses, was consumed in the inferno. Similar ironic destinies awaited the fall of Pompeii, Shoot the Chutes, and the House of Too Much Trouble. A specter had hung over Coney Island since Edison had staged that ugly scene of mob justice, the electrocution of Topsy the elephant. When the crowds came to gawk at the smoldering landscape of ash and mangled metal, the fire soon began to be referred to as Topsy's revenge. About how the unconscious mind would express thoughts banished to the unconscious. The bad thoughts had a way of coming back like a bad penny. During his 1909 visit to America, after the death of Topsy and before the karmic reckoning of the Dreamland fire, Sigmund Freud actually visited Dreamland in Coney Island. This was not long after Freud had published his groundbreaking book on the interpretation of dreams that had brought him so much scientific attention. He visited the exhibition called Creation, passing under the gigantic plaster statue of a naked woman, as well as the gates of hell that shot jets of air from below at patrons as they left the exhibit. Devils would prod passerbys with their pitchforks. The trip cemented his general dislike of America.
To dreamland. I am unhappy, far from my woman. Take me to dreamland, land of the banyan, land of plentiful pleasures of pines, potatoes on tables laden with good things. Eat at my table, she cried to the vineyards, calling the workers home from the meadows. Man, you are evil, get out of my garden. Ours is a good place, home of the reindeer. Sell me your pony, your fast golden pony. I need his strength and his terrible footsteps. Riding the prairie, just me and my angel. Just try and stop us, we're going to love. Open your window, woman of Palestine. Throw down your raiment and cover us over.
You have been listening to Nothing to See Here, experimental radio from Ascot University. This episode was entitled Topsy's Revenge. This audio collage contained the voices of Jim Morrison, John Haskell, and David Albert. Excerpts from texts by Alfonso Lingus, Graham Harmon, and Jean-Luc Nancy. It featured music by Popol Vuh, Yves Agoyan, Martin Bartlett, Valadier Signerson, The Beatles, Elizabeth Wheeler, and Harry Anthony. It featured material and voices by Raph MacDonald, Mark Hines, Talis Clark, and David Clark. Sound design and mixing were by David Clark. For more episodes of Nothing to See Here, please search for Nothing to See Here Radio on SoundCloud.com. Please like us on Facebook and tune in next week for more of Nothing to See Here.